TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. George Monbiot, The Age of Consent. George Monbiot is a British political activist and author. He writes a weekly column for The Guardian of London. Monbiot is currently visiting professor of planning at Oxford Brookes University. He's the recipient of the United Nations Global 500 Award for Outstanding Environmental Achievement, presented by Nelson Mandela. George Monbiot has written a new book, The Age of Consent, published by HarperCollins in London. In it, he lays out the problems of globalization, the dictatorship of institutions such as the World Bank, the IMF, the World Trade Organization, and the UN Security Council. And he comes up with a surprising solution. His 4 points laid out in the book are the creation of a world parliament, the scrapping of the UN Security Council, the closure of the IMF and World Bank, and their replacement with an international clearing union, first proposed by John Maynard Keynes. This would eliminate the third world's debt problems. And the replacement of the WTO with a global trade regime that protects the rights of workers and the natural world. Michael Meeker wrote about The Age of Consent, quote, "This is an extremely important book, a rigorous analysis of the sources of American power, and breathtaking in its radicalism. It is difficult to fault the logic that brings justice and prosperity to the world." End of quote. George Monbiot was interviewed by Jeff Blankford on KZYX Radio in November 2003. Monbiot began by explaining why previous models of change, such as the Communist Manifesto, did not succeed. Now he comments on anarchism.
I used to see myself in the days when I first had a formulated political position as an anarchist. But again, examining the position more carefully, I've come to see that there are very grave problems with anarchy. One of those is that unless all states disappear magically, simultaneously, spontaneously around the world, the state will always have more power than the anarchist commune. So if there's if the state wants something which the anarchist commune has, the state will be able to seize it. The anarchist commune cannot defend itself against the state. But secondly, even if somehow there was this complete transformation and all the states disappeared, you still get left with this problem whereby the powerful communities are just as free as the powerless communities. And you know, if you have problems envisaging the outcome of that, just picture a community of impoverished black people living next door to a community of well-armed white racists. In both cases, completely autonomous communities within their own community land, they can do whatever they want to do. But what is there to stop the community of well-armed white racists from attacking and invading the community of impoverished black people? You can see that there's a real problem here, and one that anarchism, for all I've read of it and for all I once believed in it, does not actually address. So it appears to me that we are forced, really, to come down to a system which is in many ways grotesquely imperfect. It is the least worst system. It's not the best system we can devise. Well, it is the best system, but it's only the best system because it's not as bad as all the alternatives. But we've got to remember here that we're dealing with human beings, and as Kant said, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. And if that applies to anything, it sure as hell applies to political systems. But the only system which is not as bad as all the other systems seems, to my mind, to be democracy. Now, the problem we've got is that while we have democracy or nominal democracy, you may question the term in California at the moment and in the United States in general, well, we have that at the national level. At the global level, there is none. At the global level, we have a dictatorship. We have a handful of institutions backed by a handful of nations which decide how everybody else is going to live. the United Nations is controlled by the Security Council, which is controlled by the five permanent members. Those five, any one of them, can veto a decision taken by every other member of the United Nations if it so wishes. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank are controlled on that time-honored democratic principle of $1, one vote. The countries with the biggest dollar contribution have the most votes, and that means that while they operate almost exclusively in the poor world, they are controlled exclusively by the rich world. So the countries in which they operate have no control over the way they operate whatsoever. The World Trade Organization, in theory, is more democratic. In practice, it's controlled by what's called the Quad, these powerful groups of nations, the US, European Union, Japan, and Canada. In other words, we have a dictatorship of the rich and powerful at the global level, and no democratic means whatsoever by which the people of the world can have their needs met, rather than just the needs of the bankers on Wall Street or in London, and the people in the White House, and the big corporations. And so my approach to this is to say the only way forward appears to be, the only progressive way forward, to try to democratize globalization and to globalize democracy, to seize the reins of global power and to turn global power, which is now vested in the hands of these few institutions, into a matter of popular power rising up from the grassroots.
And you see the emergence of World Social Forum and actually the efforts of World Bank and IMF dignitaries to get credibility in that forum as the first step in this.
This is very interesting. World Social Forum in Porto Alegre in Brazil in January, 100,000 people came. People came from all over the world. Just about every nation on earth was represented there. And what they established in coming together in the biggest political meeting the world has ever seen, they established something which all the other groups at the international level are lacking, the big institutions are lacking, and this is moral authority. They said, we are the people of the world, and we are speaking on behalf of the people of the world. Now, we could go into that in a minute, to what extent they are at the Social Forum, but nobody else is doing this. And as a result of that, people from the powerful institutions and nations came flocking to the World Social Forum. More MPs went there from France than went to the World Economic Forum, which was the official intergovernmental meeting. The president of the World Bank, James Wolfensohn, applied to come and speak at the World Social Forum, and the organizers told him to clear off. He wasn't welcome. And what this shows is that when you get together and say, you know, we are the world's people, no one else is speaking on our behalf, we're speaking for ourselves, you start to wield this thing called moral authority. Now, moral authority is critical to the functioning of any democracy. And indeed, democracies cannot function without it, because it's the only thing by which the people can hold the powers to account. What I'm suggesting is that we seek massively to enhance that moral authority, and that parallel to the big self-appointed meetings of the World Social Forum and the national and regional social forums we see around the world, we see a process of election. We see a process whereby those people who can't represent themselves, who don't have time, who don't have money, who don't have passports, who aren't able-bodied, who aren't literate, the majority of the world's people, if you put them all together, they too can be represented. And so what we're talking about here is, alongside the participatory democracy of the World Social Forum, a system of representative democracy. And this is the first plank, the first of my four proposals for transforming the world, the way the world is run. The first proposal is for a directly elected world parliament.
And how would that be conducted?
Well, it seems to me that the key task to begin with is for a world parliament to hold the existing powers to account. It wouldn't, at least in the first instance, be a legislative body. It wouldn't have direct power and say, you shall do this, and if you don't do it, we're going to send an army to attack you. That to me is the wrong way forward. If you went down that route, you get the problem whereby if, and it almost certainly would be, it became an oppressive power, no one can escape from it. We can't clear off to another planet. It could become very oppressive indeed. So it seems to me that that the right way forward here is to start off with a body which works entirely on the basis of that moral authority, which has already proved to be a powerful force at the World Social Forum. But in this case, it would have far more moral authority because it would be far more representative, and it would actually be representing communities of everybody around the world. It would then draw up principles of good global governance through the democratic process within the parliament. It would then go to the other international institutions and say, well, you are breaching principles A to Z in our list of the principles of good governance. How do you account for yourselves? And those institutions would have one of two unpleasant options. The first one is to try to brush it off and ignore it and refuse to turn up and account for themselves. Because if they did that, they then sacrifice any possibility of political credibility. They sacrifice any possibility that their claim to be acting on behalf of the people of the world can be taken seriously. Their second option is to say, all right, well, we'll turn up and go through the motions and say what we have to say. But of course, in turning up, you are recognizing the authority of the parliament. And in recognizing its authority once, you enhance its ability to call you to account a second time.
One of the point that you is quite clear is that all of the relations and all the future is tied up in the global economy, which, as you mentioned and you see well documented in the book, controlled by those who have and who bleed the raw materials from the countries that actually the producer countries, and have created a debt system that makes it impossible for the poorer countries to ever get out of debt. And in fact, you point out, and it's very important documentation, going back to Bretton Woods, where the International Monetary Fund and World Bank arose from following World War II, that there was a major debate at the time that took place in which the U.S. dominated that debate to make sure the current system is in place, when in fact an alternative system proposed by John Maynard Keynes from Britain, which would have provided the basis for a more relatively egalitarian system of exchange, was defeated. Perhaps you could say a little bit about that.
This debate has been almost entirely forgotten. It was really a contest eventually between John Maynard Keynes and Harry Dexter White, the Treasury's negotiator, a very able, very brilliant negotiator who effectively forced the hand of Britain and the other nations around the world. He threatened that the U.S. would withhold its lend-lease agreement, in other words, its loans, to continue the war against Hitler unless Britain signed up to the U.S. proposal. And it's one of the most profound historical ironies that Harry Dexter White, just 4 years later, was hauled before the House Un-American Affairs Committee and charged with being a Soviet spy. It was, in fact, him who established the system which has allowed the U.S. to sustain its political and economic hegemony over the 60 years since the Bretton Woods meeting. Fascinating quirk of history. But before that meeting began, about a year before, John Maynard Keynes, the great economist, had published a proposal which he had spent 12 years working on. And when he published it, it detonated in the minds of all who read it. It was described by Lord Robbins, a famous economist here in Britain, as having the effect of electrifying the civil servants in the Treasury here. Well, you can take it from me, it takes an awful lot to electrify the civil servants in the Treasury. It had an amazing effect all around the world. Just about everywhere, economists said, Keynes has cracked it. He has finally found the solution, not just to the problem of debt and the balance of trade, but also to the problem of global economic stability. He'd created the means of preventing another Great Depression. He'd created also the means of preventing the economy from getting so wildly out of kilter that the poor nations remain poor and remain indebted, and the rich nations become more powerful. And this system, very briefly, was this. It was for a bank at the international level, which he called an international clearing union, and all participating nations would have their trade accounts in that bank. Now, when you or I put $100 in the bank, we expect by the end of the year to have $105 because we expect to get interest on it. And we expect if we go overdrawn, if we're $100 in deficit, that we'll have to pay $110 by the end of the year because we'll be charged interest on this. Now, what's interesting about Keynes's proposal is that if nations go overdrawn, in other words, if their trade account goes into deficit, they'll be charged interest just as you or I would be charged interest in our banks. But if they go into credit, if their trade account goes into surplus, they will also be charged interest. And all these nations will be charged interest at the end of the year, and at quite punitive rates. And so before the end of the year, they would have a very powerful incentive to clear their account, in other words, to end up with zero, with neither a trade deficit nor a trade surplus. Now, if the countries in surplus collectively seek to clear their accounts by changing their terms of trade, in other words, by exporting less and importing more, the net result of that is that they are shifting the balance of trade back into the deficit nations. In other words, by clearing their surplus accounts, they're also clearing the deficit accounts of the other countries. And so what you have here is this brilliant, automatic, self-correcting system, which means that the pressure is not just on the indebted and the deficit nations as it is today, it's on all the nations to do something about the imbalance of trade. Now, what Keynes had noticed was that the imbalance of trade, the trade deficits, is a major component of debt for sovereign nations. So if you have a nation like Tanzania and it's trading at a loss this year, that means that that adversely affects its whole balance of payments, its possibility for investment, its value of its currency and all the rest of it, which makes it much harder for Tanzania to trade at a surplus next year. So if it has a deficit this year, it's going to have a deficit next year, a deficit the year after. You've got this accumulating deficit, which then turns into permanent debt, which then turns into compound debt. Now, Keynes recognized that. And he was, of course, acting at the time on behalf of not Tanzania or Mozambique or Indonesia, all of which were at the time European colonies, but a country which also had very serious debt problems, which was Great Britain. And what he recognizes is that unless you can sort out that trade deficit problem, you won't sort out the debt problem. And so by cracking the trade deficit, by basically eliminating the possibility of permanent trade deficits, you effectively undermine the major reason for international debt. By undermining the major reason for international debt, you then remove the possibility that the creditor nations become ever more powerful and the debtor nations become ever weaker and poorer. And when Keynes's proposal was rejected by the Americans at Bretton Woods, and this other proposal for a World Bank and an International Monetary Fund was introduced instead, economists all over the world, including some in the United States, pointed out that the result would be a disaster for the poorer nations, that they would fall further and further into debt, the richer nations would gain ever greater power over them. And I think 60 years later, we can say that those people have been vindicated.
We see with the agricultural protection subsidies for the U.S. and the Western countries have done to the agricultural production of countries like Mexico or even in Latin America and Africa.
This is really, you know, at the higher end of craziness. You've got 25,000 cotton farmers in the United States receiving $3.9 billion of subsidies a year. And as a result of those subsidies, the global price of cotton is about half of what it should be, with the result that tens of millions of cotton farmers and their dependents in places like West Africa, Bangladesh, North Africa, some of the poorest parts of the world, are effectively thrown out of work. And there is starvation, death through malnutrition-related diseases, death through all sorts of other preventable sanitation-related diseases, directly as a result of those massive subsidies for 25,000 cotton farmers. Now, I'm not saying the European Union is any better. We're, in fact, in some ways even worse. Every dairy cow in the European Union receives an average of $2 a day in terms of subsidies. Now, one-fifth of the world's population of human beings is living on less than $1 a day. The dairy cows are richer than the human beings.
Well, certainly the reversal of the present situation is obligatory if we're going to change anything. Now, you point out in the books a number of contradictions within the anti-globalization movement that really fails to understand the nature of the debt relationship, the nature of trade. And I think it might be useful, because many of our listeners have been involved in the globalization movement, to discuss some of those contradictions. By the way, my guest is Georges Monbiot, author of The Age of Consent. Perhaps you might talk about some of the contradictions and view you have of the globalization movement.
Well, I regard myself very much as a part of the global justice movement, and it is an incredibly diverse movement. But I do feel that one of the problems it is facing, especially within the rich world, is that much of the discourse has been dominated by people who would describe themselves as localizers, who quite understandably want to bring power and money and economics and everything back to the local level, because, of course, at the local level we have some semblance of democratic control. Now, I can understand why they take that approach. Indeed, it was an approach I used to take myself, but I've come to regard it as insufficient. Climate change, international debt, the balance of trade between nations, war and peace, nuclear proliferation, all of those issues can only be resolved at the global level. They cannot be resolved at the national or the local level. So if we withdraw from global politics, we leave them to other people to resolve, or indeed not to resolve. We leave our primary interests in the hands of those to whom we are opposed. Secondly, it's clear that even if we try to pursue the most advanced and progressive policies at home, without a transformation of the global landscape, we can't do that. In other words, without global democracy, there's no possibility for national democracy. Until we can take the reins of power at the global level, they will seize the reins of power from us at the national level. Now, on the economic front, I feel that localization paradoxically leads to a profound injustice, and I'll try to spell out why. The basic problem is that those people who say we should aim for self-reliance in manufacturing, we should protect our economies to prevent our jobs from going abroad and all the rest of it, are speaking very much from the perspective of the rich world. Because the rich world can do that. We can pursue self-reliance at home. In the United States, you can do it. Here in Great Britain, we can do it. Because there's sufficient consumer demand. There's sufficient wealth within our economies to do that. But if we say we're going to produce all our own manufacturers for our own markets, and we're not going to let in the manufacturers from other countries to compete with ours, we effectively then condemn those other countries to trading only in raw materials. And if they can only trade in raw materials, then they're stuck in an even worse economic position than they are at the moment. And at the same time, we effectively force them to be self-reliant, because if we've gone to self-reliance, and if we say that self-reliance is the way forward and everybody should produce their own manufacturers for their own markets, then obviously, if we're doing that, they have to do that too, because it's a rich world which dominates the way the global economy works. And if you go to an economist in Ethiopia and say, you should be producing your own cars and your own computers, well, she would just laugh in your face. Because, of course, there's very little purchasing power in Ethiopia. And so every car or every computer would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to manufacture, because the market is so small. And where would those dollars come from? Well, if they're only able to sell raw materials to the rich nations, it's very hard to see how they're going to be able to generate those dollars. So we have a system proposed by the localizers which is supposed to be a system which actually leads to greater global justice, but it seems to me that it leads to greater global injustice. And instead, I've proposed a trading system which permits the countries which are poor today to follow the routes to development taken by the countries which are rich today. And I won't go into this in depth because it would take a long time, but those two routes are principally what is called infant industry protection, a term first coined by Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, in 1789, and the policy which the U.S. followed all the way until 1913, indeed between 1864 towards the end of the Civil War, which was incidentally principally a war between protectionists and free traders. The protectionists won. Between 1864 and 1913, the U.S. was the most heavily protected economy on Earth, and throughout that period it was also the fastest growing. And basically, it was protecting its small industries against foreign competition until they were big enough to stand on their own 2 feet. Now, I think poor nations should be able to do that. Rich nations should not be able to do that. Protectionism should be a privilege granted to the poor, but which is withheld from the rich. At the moment, it's pretty well the other way around. At the same time, they should have free use of the rich world's intellectual property for trade within their own borders and with other poor nations. And again, that's been absolutely essential to all the countries which have succeeded in developing in the past, be it the US, be it the United Kingdom, be it Japan, Taiwan, Korea, you name it. They've had to make free use of other people's intellectual property. And again, at the moment, the World Trade Organization demands precisely the opposite. For me, that is the just way forward. That is the distributive way forward. Bringing down the barriers, as soon as we start losing jobs and we start losing wealth, seems to me to be entirely contrary to everything this movement is supposed to stand for. We, for the past however many years, we have been saying what we want to see is a massive transfer of wealth from the rich world to the poor world. As soon as that transfer of wealth starts to happen, we say that this should stop. We should start protecting our economies. It seems grotesquely contradictory.
You heard an excerpt of a 45-minute long interview with George Monbiot, a British columnist for The Guardian, and author of The Age of Consent. The book will be published in the U.S. in the summer of 2004. Monbiot also wrote Captive State, The Corporate Takeover of Britain. He was interviewed by Jeff Blankford on KZYX in November 2003. You can contact George Monbiot via his website at www.monbiot.com. That's MONBIOT.com. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on George Monbiot on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of the full 45-minute long interview with George Monbiot by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order really helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term. The time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.